Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Hey guys, this is episode 10 and the season final of Sublimely Gothic. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And for each final, we are going to pick apart the gothic elements in a famous mainstream book series or franchise that otherwise is not considered gothic, showing us the genre's overarching influence on pulp culture. If you were paying attention to my many references throughout this entire season, we are talking about, yes, you guessed it, Harry Potter, the boy who lived. But before we dive in, we have a very special announcement for all you Potterheads out there. Jess and I are going to start a Harry Potter podcast in January 2021. We're still working on the format and by which angle we'll approach the series. It will be an interesting reread because it shall be my first ever reread since the Rowling transphobic scandal. And so from that, I want our podcast to place more emphasis on the text itself and the culture surrounding the text, rather than trying to pick apart authorial intent, because at this point, the only way I can enjoy Harry Potter right now is to apply the death of the author mentality.
Yeah, you know, with that in particular, I was thinking about the writers that we've read, and I thought, we don't know everything about these people. We just know the stories that they've presented. And if we've would look into some of their histories, I don't know. It's all very complex and interesting. And I guess I would be the role of the kind of, I've read most of Harry Potter. I have the books to my left where I'm sitting at my desk. Ugh, can't talk. Sit. Ugh. Anyway, I have them. I'm going to read the final few before we talk. So they will be fresh in my mind.
Yeah. And then we'll go over each chapter, probably not each chapter, but like every two chapters, because even just covering two chapters per episode weekly, that literally takes 2 years. I'm all for it because I'm a Potterhead. But before we get into discussing the gothic within Harry Potter, I need to ask you, Jess, a few very critical Harry Potter questions.
Let's do it.
So, tell us in general about your relationship with Harry Potter, because you are a little older than me by like 5 years. So I'm just curious about how Harry Potter entered your life and in what way.
First of all, good. I've wondered that because I knew I was a little older, but I didn't know how much. I'm sure you know, when was the first book published?
It was 96 or 97. So I was born in 91. So I was like still a little young for it. So like I didn't get into them until I was like 12 or 13. And by that point, 4 of the books were already published.
Okay.
So first one, 96, 97.
You know, I remember it kind of like was gaining momentum. And I remember, I think my most vivid Harry Potter memory, to be quite honest, I have a good friend in Colorado. Hi, Zane. Love you much. And I remember going to a concert and the book, I think it was maybe the third or fourth book. I don't remember exactly. I have two memories and it's other people reading it. So I remember us going to a concert. He got the book. I think we stopped at a bookstore and I was falling asleep and he was sitting there on the bed next to me reading through it. And then I remember when the final book came out, because I worked at a coffee shop and a guy came in and you could tell like that this was like he planned his day. He was going to drink coffee and just read the book. And that's what I watched him do for most of the day, which was very nice. So I kind of do this thing where I've picked the books up every around in the fall, you know, just kind of like around October, and maybe I've read like one or two of them and then I will read something else. So I still have two more books to go. So mm-hmm. And then I do have a very early edition. My mom was a teacher, so she had one for her classroom, and I have it in a box in the basement. So I don't know if it's a first edition or not, but and then I do remember seeing the movie at Christmas. Weirdly enough, I used to see the movies with Zane every time they came out, and then I moved, and I haven't seen the final movie. So how about you, Amy? You gave a little bit of information, and that was other people's experience with Harry Potter than my own, but.
Yeah, mine is, I'm just a hardcore, you know, early 90s millennial. And so I'm exactly in that sub-generation group that grew up with Harry Potter and aged with Harry Potter, and just a whole staple of my childhood was waiting for the next Harry Potter book. And when 2007 came, it's like, there's no more Harry Potter books. Life has no meaning now.
Yeah. You weren't alone in that feeling.
Yeah. And so just, you know, I didn't reread the books as often as my sister would. Like, she would read them like once a year or once every 2 years. Like, I wasn't doing that. But only recently, like within the last 2 years, I reread the whole series again after I became pagan, because I wanted to figure out, do crazy conservative Christians have a point? Are they trying to promote paganism? And of course they're not.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
So, so that prompted one rereading, and I really got into, you know, just listening to Harry Potter podcasts, because that's a huge part of the Harry Potter fandom. And actually, I'm currently listening to one Harry Potter podcast, The Fox and the Foxhound, where they like take questions, like, you know, listeners can submit questions and they answer them. So I recorded myself asking a question and they took it. And so they responded to my question on their show for their, when they started the fifth book.
Oh, nice. Okay.
The hosts are named Amanda and Kevin, and they agreed that they would love to be guests on our podcast when we do it.
Oh, sweet. Okay, cool.
So we've already got a few guest speakers lined up.
Okay. That's great.
Another question. What was your favorite book out of all the ones you've read so far?
Oh, man. I'm going to have to look at the covers. This is challenging my memory. I can tell you probably what happened in them. Oh, do we need to do a spoiler thing? I mean, because...
Oh, yeah. This is spoilers. I'm going to try not to spoil just for the last two books, but at the very least, we're going to go up to all the events of book five. So if you're not up to speed, spoilers alert, stop listening.
Yeah. And I think I know enough that it's not going to be too spoilery. The only I have some questions about some things that I've seen pieces of, because it's so just ingrained in pop culture. But I think it was A Prisoner of Azkaban, if that's the one with Sirius Black. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I really liked that one. I couldn't really tell you why I liked it so much, but I just think maybe it's a little bit of a love of there's a freaking werewolf in it. Like, how cool is that? So
yeah. I think Prisoner of Azkaban is a favorite, especially amongst the first three, if people have to pick one, because people start to think that's when it really starts to pick up.
Her writing style, and we can talk about, I'm sure we'll talk about this a lot, but it just amazed me how it, being that in tune with an audience and kind of progressing in writing style to kind of be in line with the age of the reader. As you said, you know, I was an adult when I read these, and I'm like, this is still a very enjoyable book and a very good reading experience. I really admire that. I think that's really something else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, book three, I like Prisoner of Azkaban. It was the one that stands out the most. I had to look at the cover to remember which one it was, but...
Okay. Who was your favorite character?
Man. Are you going to answer these questions too? Because I'm like, I feel like I'm not. I like Hermione. Harry gives me some issues. Oh, gosh. This is racking my brain. I'm not to the point where, like, Snape, I'm okay with him yet. Because I know that's the thing that I've seen. Does Luna Lovegood show up there yet?
Luna Lovegood is my favorite character, and she does not show up till book five.
Okay. Well, I liked her. So I didn't, or did I read it about, maybe I, so I think I maybe read like half of book five because I liked her, like how they introduced her as a character. She was on the train, right? And okay. She is my favorite, even though I've only read half of that book. And, but with Prisoner of Azkaban, I don't know. I kind of like Sirius Black. I thought he was an interesting guy. I liked how he was the evolution of that. So
yeah, no, Sirius Black is a top favorite amongst many fans.
Cool. Okay. Well then good. So, I'm not like picking out assholes. I guess that's good.
So which Hogwarts house would you be in, do you think?
I meant to do the Sorting Hat before we got on this call, but then my work was so silly I couldn't do it. I'm going to get, can I guess which one you're in?
Yeah, just no, you're going to guess, and then officially with our Harry Potter podcast, you're going to do it. You're going to take the real quiz.
Okay. I think that I would love to be Ravenclaw, but I'm a Hufflepuff, so.
I am a hardcore Hufflepuff.
Really? Okay.
Yes, I am, because as much as I adore Ravenclaw and their respect for learning, if learning does not have a moral compass, as we learned in The Historian last episode, that knowledge and technology can lead to scary things. So I am all for being a good moral standing Hufflepuff.
Good. And that makes sense that we get along so well. So we're both Hufflepuffs. I think I've, you know, because people kind of rag on that house, I feel like, but I've
people like to crap on that house because it doesn't have any exactly glamorous qualities. And again, that's the whole point, because they're a little more humble and again, a little more moral and, you know, aren't so full of themselves.
I mean, we do have Robert Pattinson. I know he does not stay around that long, but so there we go.
Yeah, no, I was also thinking about that. It's like, no, Cedric, don't leave Bella.
Oh, I know. It is, that's an interesting thing. You know what, now that you say that, and I remember the Fantastic Beasts movies, you know, came out a couple of years ago. And I think I was trying to learn how to knit, and I knitted a scarf like, oh my gosh, the name escapes me. Eddie Redmayne, that's the actor's name. But he wore so like the Hufflepuff colors, but it was kind of vintage looking. So it's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah. Although I just watched Eddie Redmayne's movie. It was on Netflix and Amazon Prime, The Danish Girl, where he portrays that trans woman. It's really good.
Yeah. I'll have to watch that.
But anyway, Eddie Redmayne aside.
Yes.
So the structure of this episode will naturally be a little different, but hopefully not too unfamiliar. We're basically just going to have a free-flowing discussion discussing the Gothic elements, but we're going to organize it by our Gothometer. So we're going to, you know, list off our five categories. We'll take one category and list all the possible elements that we can possibly think of within the Harry Potter universe that fits in that category and kind of discuss them. And then once we've exhausted that category, we'll move on to the next one and then the next one and so on and so forth.
I did a little research before in the time that I could. So I think I feel like I can at least know some things to talk about here. Our friend Julia has a post about the Gothic elements in Harry Potter too. So
I saw that. It's one of the top links on Google. Yeah, like when you do Gothic elements Harry Potter, like hers is right up there.
Yes, that is why I stumbled upon it, I think so.
Yeah, although I have a little bit of a confession to make. So the Gothometer, you know, I looked, you know, through all sorts of articles on how people define Gothic to come to a decision on, you know, the categories for our Gothometer. But if I'm being really, really honest, these very specific five categories, they come from an article about Gothic within Harry Potter.
I didn't know that. That's really funny because I found this similar Gothometer on other things related to Gothic literature. So I was like, good job, Amy. You kind of condensed it down. So
yeah, so there's a article on the leakycauldron.org, which is called Harry Potter and the Gothic Novel by Elizabeth Murray. And again, she breaks it down into the five, you know, atmosphere and setting, the past, the supernatural, the heroes, heroines, villains, and mystery.
It's completely logical. And I have to say that when I was doing a little bit of research, I was like, it just blows my mind now that Harry Potter isn't thought, the Harry Potter series is not thought of as a gothic series.
Mm, yeah. It's all about tone. Yeah. So, alrighty then. So we'll start with our first category. We're not going to cheat and look at the League of Cauldron episode. We're going to have to think on our own.
Okay.
So category number one, atmosphere and setting. So we have to go through all the places in Harry Potter universe that we feel can warrant, you know, gothic discussion. My first one that I have written down, first and foremost, Hogwarts, the castle. Hidden away on the Scottish highlands.
You got it. I'm seeing it in my mind's eye of just the visual from the movies. It's a castle. It has years and years and years of history. Hogwarts, absolutely. Again, when I'm thinking about this more, it is just amazing to me. The whole atmosphere is gothic. I mean, I don't think of Sunshine and Roses. When I think of Harry Potter, I think of like overcasty castles and, you know, creaky hallways and ghosts hanging out and by paintings, all kinds of things like that.
Yeah, and then it's not just a castle, it has secret passageways. The staircases move. As we discussed in our Castle of Otranto episode, it has moving portraits.
We talked
about that extensively with Julia in the Castle of Otranto episode, because I can't think of any other series, you know, that's a distinctly gothic thing that was, you know, taken and expanded upon to the degree that it is in the Harry Potter universe.
Yeah, that's a pretty key part of, I mean, at least like when they get to Hogwarts, the paintings are what let them past, like, to get into their certain house, right?
Yeah, for specifically Gryffindor, yeah, their tower is guarded by a talking portrait who has a password.
Okay, pretty gothic there.
What other elements of Hogwarts make you think of gothic?
Well, just like ghosts are kind of part of it. I know that's more of the supernatural, but they're connected to it. I'm thinking about Moaning Myrtle, which, of course. Kind of more comic. Secret passageways, chemistry labs. I don't know.
Yeah, no, they learn their potions in the dungeons.
Yes. Yes.
Which are dark and dreary, and then the potions is taught by the most gothic incel you can possibly think of.
Gothic incel, that's great.
Gothic emo incel.
Dude, that's such a great way to describe him. I was going to say, like, I probably look like him right now, but that's fine. Sometimes I look like good old Snape, but that's okay, because I have long dark hair and I wear black all the time. But
in the earlier works, J.K. Rowling has gone to say that she originally was going to have a vampire teacher at Hogwarts, but she decided against it. And she's gone on several times to say that no, Snape is not a revamped, like, former vampire. Snape is his own thing, who already had his own, like, storyline. But she was considering having a vampire, but decided against it.
Are there vampires in Harry Potter?
There are. They exist. We only meet like one in book six very briefly. And I don't have trouble telling you this because it's not relevant to the plot. Rowling has gone on to say that, you know, she feels like vampires have, no pun intended, like, you know, so many nails have been driven into that coffin that she didn't want to go into that, and especially because her series so much focuses on traditional British folklore and she didn't want to appropriate Eastern European folklore.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's, well, first of all, I feel better because, like, I was like, did I totally forget about a vampire? I didn't.
No, you didn't. Yeah, that's a deliberate thing that she decided that she wasn't going to go that route.
Honestly, I would have been surprised if I would have forgotten it because, you know, like, got the love for vampires. I know, I'm sorry, I took a deviation from atmosphere there. Atmosphere and setting. So could we argue that the aunt and uncle's house is kind of, well, it's definitely miserable. I forget what their names are. They're the horrible
people. The Dursleys.
Yes. It's kind of gothic in its own way because they're total assholes. but
yeah, they just suck the life out of everything. They're gothic in like their character, not their setting, but I feel like their characterization is gothic because, you know, very much reminds me of, who is it? Oh, Jane Eyre and her terrible like aunt, and you know, the evil aunt and uncle is such a trope, not just in gothic literature, but especially so in gothic literature, that the protagonist is this orphan that's been, you know, that is neglected by his extended family and has to like find his own way.
Okay, so the characters are more gothic-y than the actual house itself.
Yeah, because the house, the Dursleys' house, is considered basically like suburbia. It's like supposed to be the absolute most normal looking, you know, how is possible.
Right, because they're all mad that, I mean, there's any deviation from the normal, which Harry is a deviation from the norm. I was thinking about some of the other settings in Harry Potter, which I'm thinking of Diagon Alley, which I don't know if that's really gothic-y, but the names in some of the shops, I mean, the Leaky Cauldron, that's kind of... sounds kind of a...
You know what part of it is gothic? I didn't write down Diagon Alley, but it's like side alley, Nocturne Alley.
Okay.
Do you remember Nocturne Alley?
No.
Okay, so Nocturne Alley is this offshoot of Diagon Alley, and it's where all like the dark art stores and all the creepy stores are. The best way I can describe it is just think of like pouring down rain, like really grimy Victorian London, terrible urban, you know, that is Nocturne Alley.
Okay. I don't remember where that shows up at.
Yeah, it shows up. We first see Nocturne Alley in book 2.
Okay.
Because Harry has a mistake when he's trying to travel magically to Diagon Alley. So he ends up next door in Nocturne Alley and ends up in this super creepy shop, which the shop ends up being very, very important later on in book 6. But I digress.
Okay. Now I'm like, did I read book 2? I don't know. Goodness, I've read these over like a span of time, which I'm equating this to people having to wait, like, you know, to get the books. But I don't know. Then some people are like, why haven't you just blazed through them? I don't know, man. I've been doing other things. I don't know.
One setting I think of is, you know, right next to Hogwarts is the Forbidden Forest.
Yes.
So, of course, forests are, you know, can be considered gothic. We get them plenty in, you know, we get it in Uncle Silas. You know, there's a few scenes that occur in like a forest or outside. I think of the Forbidden Forest because it's not just a forest, but when we're first introduced to the forest in book 1, do you remember what happens?
I mean, is that the one, are there spiders in that, or is that later on?
That is in the Forbidden Forest, but that is book 2. That's later.
Okay, so I'm obviously doing a really good job of mixing these all up.
No, it's okay. No, but in the first year, when they end up going into the Forbidden Forest, they go with Hagrid because there's something that has killed a unicorn. And unicorns are like really fast, and you know, they don't understand what could possibly be hunting a unicorn. So like really responsible adults, they're going to bring in like 3 or 4 11-year-olds to figure out what sort of demon is assaulting unicorns, the purest creature on earth.
Yeah, is that where the Dementors have not shown up yet, or was it a Dementor that I don't remember?
Yeah, you're so cute, Jess.
Like so many things.
Dementors are book 3.
Okay.
So no, what happens in book 1 in the Forbidden Forest is Harry finds like this sort of spirit-esque thing of Voldemort sucking the unicorn's blood in a really vampiric way. And it's like really, and you know, people go on and on about, you know, the books don't get really dark to like the end of book 4 and then like moving forward. But like once I think about it, like if you just took away a little bit of the whimsical tone that was deliberately put on the first few books, that is pretty dark.
Yeah, it's like I know I've mentioned the Hunger Games, and which, sure, the overarching thing is like kids killing each other. But having just read The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, I was kind of really taken aback at how dark it was. So I think there might be an element of people going like, oh no, this is for kids, it's all good. But that's kind of like old, you know, fairy tales. If people read those are horrible.
So, oh yeah, like the old school Cinderella, like where her sisters like cut their feet off, you know, trying on the glass slipper. Like, yeah, though, like the original Grimm tales are really gory.
Yeah, people gotta realize. I mean, so I just wonder how, you know, if my mission before January is to, you know, finish the series and then maybe read through it again just to see what I pick up on that I overlooked initially. That is a little graphic. You know, not necessarily graphic. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Draining the life of a unicorn is quite a bummer. Maybe a little graphic. So.
Yeah, it is. And especially because, you know, there's silver blood dripping out of its mouth.
What? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's why I choose the Forbidden Forest first for its original interaction, because that is the image of the forest we're given, our first experience with the Forbidden Forest. And then, as you rightly said, the second time we go into the Forbidden Forest again, we meet giant spiders.
Which you all know I freaking love spiders. I don't know how many times I've mentioned that I hate spiders.
And they originally, you know, go into trying to get help because Hagrid told them, like, you know, follow the spiders, and, you know, basically implying, you know, my spider buddy will tell you more of what's going on. And they try to leave, but the head spider Aragog is like, no, my friends don't hurt Hagrid, but, you know, I'm not gonna deny them fresh meat. And so they try to kill them, but then luckily the enchanted car comes to rescue them.
Oh yeah, all of that was very terrifying. What you
yeah again yeah, like right yeah down. Like huge giant spiders, huge part of Gothic, especially in relation to vampires. You know, we talked about the historian. The part that struck out to you was the big spider on Helen's shoulder, and it's so obviously Dracula.
Yes. I'm just like, here's the thing about that whole bit of the Harry Potter. I think I might have closed my eyes during that scene in the movie, because if a spider's the size of my fingernail, it freaks me out. So she's really doing a good job playing on people like me's arachnophobia. So power to her there, I guess. But that makes sense that it would be in the enchanted forest. I feel like, thankfully, Gothic literature uses spiders more symbolically. I don't really want to read a book about like Arachnophobia or something like that, which is an old movie that I've never seen because, again, I'm scared of spiders. So keep those guys in the Enchanted Forest. I would not be a willing participant on that journey. Sorry, everyone.
So another one I have on my list is, for atmosphere, Chamber of Secrets.
Refresh my memory with the Chamber of Secrets.
The Chamber of Secrets is the chamber, like, below the castle that Salazar Slytherin specifically created, and that's where the giant snake is hiding, and Harry has to go down and rescue Ginny, and he kills the basilisk, you know, giant serpent.
Okay, so this is like, again, we're talking about like the evolution of like dark themes in the Harry Potter books kind of so far. So we're talking about like the big bad, like I think that's what they call it in I think TVs and shows and whatever. So the big bad in the first book would be a giant snake.
No, the big two is the giant snake.
Okay, giant snake. Then we got some spiders. I mean,
yeah,
I know.
No, that's the whole point. Like, they go and talk to the spiders, and they think the spiders are like, are you the monsters? Like, no, that snake is what we fear above everything else. So it's like the spiders are only an afterthought to the big evil.
Okay, I'm just thinking about like how, I mean, and I know Voldemort is the ultimate, you know, baddie and all of this, but how the kind of scary things are big versions of small things. And then it kind of escalates as the series progresses is what I'm thinking. Yeah. So.
Yeah. It starts off as very like simple, like representations of evil, giant spiders, giant snakes. And then we get a little more nuanced and, you know, characterization and our, you know, Sirius Black, you know, in book 5 says the world isn't divided between good people and Death Eaters. Yeah, so the Chamber of Secrets to me, I think, is probably one of my top 3 most gothic elements of the story, because it's a hidden chamber beneath the castle, which the castle is already gothic in its own ways. And so this is the ultimate secret chamber that has a huge monster that is meant to terrorize and kill all of the witches and wizards of non-magical descent in their crazy fascist purity agenda.
Oh, yeah. This is all jogging my memory of where I stopped. So thank you for doing that. Because you were talking about wiping out the wizards. Okay. I'll catch on before I am part of a podcast which is entirely dedicated to Harry Potter.
This is why we're going to do the podcast two chapters at a time.
Good. Because, yeah, we can really dive into it. So, okay, yeah. Great.
And then I have another one, the Shrieking Shack. Do you remember where the Shrieking Shack is?
No. I'm thinking about where they find Sirius Black, but I know that's not it.
That is it.
Oh, well, then that is where they find Sirius Black.
Yeah, so they realize that the secret passage underneath the Whomping Willow is, you know, leads to the Shrieking Shack, and Sirius Black goes there, you know, to hide. But then we learn that the Shrieking Shack was the place that Remus Lupin would go to transform into a werewolf away from the other students when he was a kid at Hogwarts.
Gotcha. Okay. So I was thinking about that, but I didn't know what it was called. I just remember them going to a place that seemed very, like, in my mind, it was very, like, creaky and broken.
Yeah, it was a creaky, dilapidated house. And again, it's considered to be the most haunted dwelling in Britain, and Dumbledore, the headmaster, encouraged those rumors, but actually none of it is true. There's nothing haunted about the Shrieking Shack. What made it so scary is that people heard, like, the screaming of Remus Lupin when he was transforming into a werewolf.
Okay.
Yeah, and of course, and it's where the big confrontation between Sirius Black and the kids occurs, and, you know, a lot of stuff. Like, again, not really, again, we don't visit it too many times after that. But yeah, it's pivotal as the place of climax for book three.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that scene very vividly, and as I'm so eloquently relaying right now. But I do remember that confrontation pretty well. I didn't remember the name of the location, but that was something that seemed rather gothic to me. I feel like there are more places, you know, so much of the story that, again, that I've read and remember takes place in Hogwarts. So it's, you know, they don't really venture outside Hogwarts too much that I can remember.
In the beginning, no, they don't. But by book five, they do.
Okay.
Yeah. So do you remember Grimmauld Place?
No.
Sorry. You're killing me, Jess.
I know.
Grimmauld Place is the mansion, is the old seat estate, like the old seat of the House of Black, like Sirius's family.
Okay.
And they go there as like a sort of safe house, but it's like completely, it's very obvious that dark wizards, it was a very dark wizarding family, and Sirius isn't proud of that. And it's covered, you know, with dark, you know, curtains, cobwebs, like it hasn't been in use in for a while, but even if it was in use, it clearly had a gothic, you know, ambience.
That makes sense. I think contrasting that with like the Dursley's house, which I would not qualify that as gothic.
Yeah. And then Grimmauld Place is a play on words for grim old place.
Oh, that's cute. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely Grimmauld Place sticks out as like the sort of like typical gothic mansion but it's kind of hidden away. You don't see it. It's not out in the open like Hogwarts. It's hidden by magic in like the center of London.
That reminds me of, like I said, the point in the story that I last remember reading when they had the Quidditch match, and it was the big event that was kind of like cloaked by magic when they were playing. So that's kind of where I remember ending, or that's the most vivid memory that I have when I, where I stopped reading. So I would not qualify that as a gothic location though.
Okay. And then the last one I have here online is the Riddle House and Graveyard. Do you remember those places?
I think I do actually. I'm just have to go through my memory. I believe it's at the beginning of one of the books. Is that correct? Or am I?
Yes. Yes. It's the beginning of book four.
Okay. Okay. So that is where this is like a quiz, Amy, and I feel like I'm failing. I remember it starting there, but I'm going to have some help finishing this thought.
So the Riddle House is, it's first chapter of book four. It's the first chapter in the whole series since chapter one of number book one that were, it's not from Harry's perspective.
Yes, that really
so
stood
it's
out.
So thematically, it's a huge outlier, and it basically tells the story of the Riddles, who are like a very genteel, wealthy family, and the old Mr. Riddle and his wife and his son were all ended up dead. And the townspeople never knew who killed it, but everyone just assumes that it was the gamekeeper, Frank Bryce.
Okay. Yes.
And you learn exactly who killed the Riddles and, you know, everything like that. But to me, not only is it the typical, like, you know, mansion with like crazy, with suspicious murders and whatnot, but also the creepy groundskeeper, Frank Bryce. That is a huge staple of, you know, Gothic, you know, with the creepy butler and the creepy housekeeper.
Absolutely. I mean, even as I'm thinking in Rebecca with the, her helper, whose name is escaping me right now. Who do we talked about somebody that kind of reminded me of like Lurch. I think it was in that same conversation. Yeah. So, okay. That you've got all the locations nailed so far.
Yes. And then, and I said Riddle House and the graveyard, because, you know, we start the beginning of the book at the Riddle House, but at the end, near the end of the book, Harry ends up traveling there, you know, against his will. And it's in the graveyard that there's the crazy cult ritual and where Voldemort emerges from the cauldron and comes back to life.
Is there a snake at the beginning of this too?
Yes, Nagini is in the Riddle House in the beginning.
Yes. Okay. I remember her vividly. And mm-hmm. She shows up in the Nathaniel, or gosh darn it, Newt Scamander. Books.
They decided to do the whole backstory with her. We still don't know how she became evil and ended up with Voldemort, but yeah, we'll see.
Realizing how much I forget about this series, but that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Category two, the past. So how do you think? I first want to hear what you think about how the past impacts the Harry Potter series. And then I have my own little list.
Okay, good. Because we can exhaust my knowledge because it is not as in-depth. So definitely kind of the mystery of his parents died. And kind of there seems to be, as far as I've read, always kind of like some mysterious circumstances. You know, even I think every book is kind of a little mystery in itself. You're trying to figure out a resolution to something. Some action happens at the beginning. Oh, we're not talking about mystery. We're talking about the past. So things that happen, I don't know why I skipped that. But in the past, so I guess we're thinking about like his parents are a theme there. Even the history of where they are. I'm thinking, I know I keep mentioning Moaning Myrtle, but she's a ghost, so there's a past. How did she end up that way? There's always a little bit of a toe in the past. For some reason, I think of Hermione's Time Turner, which I know that's not too deep in the past, but that does help manipulate that. So,
of course. I didn't even think of Hermione and her Time Turner, but you're absolutely right. There are so many layers of the past in Harry Potter, and I will just refine your thoughts with my little bullet points. So my first one is, you know, the attack on Harry, his parents dying, and the whole thing about, you know, that he survived, and that's the whole reason why he's famous. So specifically, his parents' death and the attack is an element of the past that, of course, keeps coming up again and again. And then another element is not just his parents' death, but especially in book three, like with the confrontation in the Shrieking Shack, the past of his parents in relation with Sirius Black, in relation with Peter Pettigrew and Remus Lupin. So the whole generation of his parents, that past, and especially how that how their past friendship is interwoven with Severus Snape and why Severus Snape is so miserable.
Yeah, see, that's the part with him that I don't fully understand yet. So yeah.
In book three, we get a good deal more than we knew before. But again, it's not really expanded on too much beyond that until like the very end.
Okay. All right.
So definitely the attack on Harry, the past of his parents and the relationships within that generation. And then also the past is relevant on a wider societal level, like just the whole Wizarding Society remembering Voldemort's first reign of power and terror in the 70s. And that's like a huge collective trauma that the whole society carries and is mentioned, you know, quite often.
Yeah, to the point that it must be so traumatic they won't even say the name, right?
Yeah, I mean, so traumatic that they don't even use the name.
Right.
And then we also have, that's Voldemort's past, you know, on a, you know, collective level. On a more individual level, we also get, particularly in book two and in book six, Voldemort's past, like when he was originally, when he grew up as just a boy named Tom Riddle.
Okay. Yeah. Book two, I don't remember that. I feel like for some reason I drew a complete blank.
You need to read book two, girl.
I feel like I'm like, did I even read it? Did I get confused and just skip over it? I've done that before. So yeah, I'm definitely going to reread that one.
Yeah, specifically Voldemort's past and specifically his past at Hogwarts and what made him become the way he is, which ultimately is just the most stereotypical daddy issues.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I'm gonna kill all non-magical people and all descendants of non-magical people because my non-magical father abandoned me.
That's one way to go about it. I mean, I guess, yeah, you know,
that is literally it.
I think I'm safe to say that we are currently dealing with somebody else's daddy issues, and it is destroying our country. So.
Oh, yes. Oh, dear. And then also, I also have the Hogwarts founder's past, namely in relation to the Chamber of Secrets legend, because the whole backstory behind the Chamber of Secrets is that Salazar Slytherin, one of the founders, created the chamber and hid the giant snake in it because he got mad that the other founders, you know, didn't agree with him that they should only have pure-blooded witches and wizards in Hogwarts. They shouldn't allow those descended of non-magical people to be admitted to the school. And so he was this very fascist, racist, bigoted one, and the others didn't go along with it. So he left, and then he created the Chamber of Secrets and to have the monster giant snake to terrorize all the descendants of non-magical people. And so that past is the foundation of the prejudice that we see within the series.
I just need to take a minute and say, I forget that all of these things are kind of themes in the Harry Potter series. I have a hard time saying that. And then that makes just some of the author's decisions lately that much more confusing to me. So just some of her own.
Yeah, anyway, that's why people are so like shook up by J.K. Rowling's transphobia, because it's like she wrote this whole progressive series about not judging people based on whatever criteria, and you know, and she can't bring herself to do the same specifically with trans people.
It just makes no sense. I mean, I understand completely how people are totally, if it's,
I think it's so- a, I think yeah I think it's a generational thing. And given this is a very an apologist view, and I'm not saying I condone her behavior, I'm just like thinking, you know, maybe this is why she rationalizes it. You know, she was in she was in an abusive relationship, and clearly I think that had a bigger effect on her than she usually like tells the public. Like, people know a little about it, but she's been pretty much, you know, private about it. Mm-hmm. But clearly that's influenced her to the point that she thinks that trans people is a form of men, you know, invading women's space.
Yeah, I'm going to be really honest too here. I haven't really followed all of that too in depth. I know one of my friends was really upset by it. And I need to do my research before I talk about it too, too much. But the thing that I have seen that has just always surprised me is my perception has always been, it was like a very open-minded like world and accepting and all these things. And then to kind of have this kind of blow up, I understand how it really rocked some people's worlds. So we can get more into that later. I'm sorry, but when you were talking about those things, it just kind of stood out to me that
no, because again that is the like that foundation in the past of bigotry is what like the whole story is based on, and that is the whole basis of the ideology that Voldemort tries to promote, because he's trying to bring back his ancestors' notion of purism.
Oh, I just, you know, JK, just get off Twitter, man. Just do that.
Yeah, like. I don't know. Yeah, no, I wanted to think of her as like really like nice and humble, because like she's one of those people who went from being a billionaire to just a millionaire because she donated so much and did put money to such good causes. And I feel like finally she's kind of gotten corrupted by, I don't know whether it's her fame or her wealth or I don't know. I just wonder what sort of super privileged circles is she running in that she doesn't realize that these transphobic tweets are so tone deaf and out of touch with like the generation she wrote the series for.
Yeah. It's really surprising, because it just continues to baffle me. And I hope she maybe takes a little bit of time in the quarantine and maybe reassesses some of her thinking. I don't know.
Yeah. But I'm sure all of these things will be discussed next year.
Right. Yes. Yeah. When I have reread the books and know a little bit better what you're referring to. So.
Okay. Moving on to the supernatural. We went into some of it with the vampires and how she made a deliberate choice not to include vampires. But of course, we have werewolves, a staple of gothicness.
Yeah. The Dursleys don't want to have anything to do with the supernatural elements of their nephew's life. And then there's a whole, it's just a story of all the supernatural elements that you could want, with the exception of vampires, to an extent in one book. And then again, they're all treated, it's just part of the world that they exist in. So I think that's part of the appeal and making certain monsters less scary. And I don't know. I mean, you can't talk about Harry Potter without talking about supernatural elements. I mean, he's a wizard, and he's told that by a giant. What the hell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the only character who's a werewolf that we know who has any significant character development is Remus Lupin. And it's interesting, you know, he's a werewolf, and certainly in the beginning, like naturally, when he transforms into a werewolf, he has the typical loses his mind, loses his sanity, doesn't know, have any sense of self, and could kill anyone, even his best friend or his mother. So that's very typical. And although she went more in the direction of, you know, using werewolves as an allegory for like AIDS and like people with these specific diseases that have a certain social stigma.
Okay, that's. You know, it's really interesting you mentioned that, because I feel like I picked that up through reading it without knowing that there was some correlation she was trying to make there that, it makes sense, that information that I didn't know until now.
It's heavy in the subtext of when we're first introduced to Remus Lupin in book 3, we see that he's constantly looking pale and haggard. He's sick a lot. So it's not just like, it's like, oh, poof, I'm a werewolf on the full moon. Like, this is a condition that even if he's not officially a werewolf in werewolf form, this is a chronic illness that affects him all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, it just seems like something that seems glaringly obvious. But I think I was able to see that the kind of connection that was being made without it being, you know, a little asterisk, by the way, this is supposed to be representative of this. So great writing. I mean, it's just can't.
Again, an appealing to, you know, disenfranchised groups.
Right. Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Supernatural, Ghost, of course, we kind of touched upon that. Ghost in Harry Potter, you know, they're kind of described specifically as the imprint of a departed soul. And basically, in the Harry Potter universe, when you die, it seems you have some sort of choice. Like, if you're too scared to move on to, like, whatever lies beyond, like, you can stay in the world as a ghost. Like, that seems to be how it works.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting, because there are, it's not like overrun with ghosts, but there are, they do make very pointed appearances throughout.
Yes. And then, of course, nearly Headless Nick is a ghost we see a lot, because he's the ghost of Gryffindor Tower. But again, the ghost that gets the most sort of character development, shall we say, is, of course, the, what you mentioned, Moaning Myrtle. Which I knew you must have read book two, because Moaning Myrtle is all in book two.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I think her voice was so goofy to me. I mean, sorry, whoever that
did
actress
did you know played. That actress who played Moaning Myrtle, she was like in her 30s when she played it.
Really?
Yeah. Like, she was so old, but she has such just this girlish, you know, demeanor and voice.
She must have had like, yeah, it must be the voice. It was very unique, because I think I've seen her in some other BBC shows.
She does a lot of historical, like, period drama stuff.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, interesting. Nearly Headless Nick. I forgot about that. That character, too. But yeah, it's not as developed as Moaning Myrtle. I'm not going to do an impression. So that, though, we're talking about the supernatural. Yeah, that element of ghosts is definitely there. Werewolves, giant, scary spiders.
And it's not just like supernatural as in, oh, there's magic, but even within like the magical world, there are certain other magics that are considered like so rare that they're kind of in the supernatural category, even within the wizarding world.
Yeah.
Like, more specifically, like in book two, we find out that Harry has the ability to speak to snakes.
Oh, yeah. What is the name for that? There's a specific name.
The language is parcel tongue. The person is a parcel mouth.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this sense of, even amongst the magical world, there are some things that are so rare that people don't, you know, fully understand the ability. And specifically with parcel tongue, it's not just considered rare, it's also considered like evil.
Right. I remember that being kind of a, like, I mean, because there's kind of that kind of internal battle, I think, within him, that, you know, kind of the pull toward good and evil. That's something that, I don't know if it's something to talk about in the future, but there's always like this, if you're a supernatural character, then there's like a little bit of a specialness. There has to be like another, like, not only are you're a vampire who can read minds, you know, hear people talk. I'm thinking of Edward, I know. And, you know, they all have their little gifts within that. So.
Yeah, because writers got to make the protagonist more interesting. And if the baseline is magical world, then you got to be even more magical.
Right. Yeah, we got to up the ante there. So.
Yeah. But the most gothic of all of the creatures, however, is, of course, the Dementor.
Man, that is the creepy but cool, like, good on. I can see the visual. It's just, that is just such a cool looking scary thing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's basically a sort of grim reaper like esque figure that comes and sucks all the happiness out of you.
An emotional. So, do you know the origins of the Dementor? Other than grim reaper, I mean, seems.
Well, no. Well, just in the books, Rowling went on to say that to her, they are the personification of depression.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Which was pretty obvious from the subtext of, you know, how they were described, you know, even as early as when I read them. And I'm like, yeah, that's depression.
That's really interesting. Because they hang around Azkaban, right?
Yeah, they're the guards of Azkaban normally. But then when Sirius Black escapes and they're trying to catch him, they decide to guard Hogwarts with Dementors. And Dumbledore is not happy about this, but he lets them, guard, outside the castle walls. And yeah, and then they show up on the train. And then, the super gothic thing about them is, what they call the Dementor's Kiss. Do you remember that?
I think so, but not, I need you to clarify it for me because I couldn't tell you.
So basically, Harry asks, because they look like the Grim Reaper and they have these hoods and cloaks, and so you don't see their face. And Lupin explains to Harry that, anyone who has seen a Dementor's face is not in a position to tell anyone because a Dementor only lifts its hood to bestow the Dementor's Kiss, where they suck out the person's soul from their mouth. And basically they become a vegetable with no feeling.
I'm sorry I yelled. That is so dark. Like, oh my gosh.
That is super dark. That is the most gothic. That's one of the most gothic things that this series has.
Yes. I mean, I remember thinking, visually they were really interesting, which I don't know if we did this, and I don't know if the location is visited specifically. Maybe it is later on, but Azkaban, that's a freaking, gothic-y place. So anyway, I'm trying to give myself some points there for pointing that out. But that's really, really dark. And again, this is a kid's book. And I know you said they show up in book two or three?
Three.
Don't remember? Three. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Had a point I was going to make, but I forgot it now. Oh, well. So yeah, it's Dementors. And it's obvious from the name and it derives from, the word demented.
Yeah. I don't know why. They're just stylistically pretty cool looking.
Yeah, no, a lot of people, in the terms of the movie had a different director than movies one and two. And a lot of people actually really hate movie number three because they don't like the stylistic choices that guy made. But quite honestly, I like how he went full on into the gothic, completely highlighting the Dementors in that way. So I approved.
Maybe we should save this for later, talking about what movie you liked the most. So I'll hold off on that question.
Okay. But yeah, that's sort of the apex of creatures, or the supernatural, the Dementors in terms of gothiciness. And then there's category four, heroes, heroines, and villains. I think this one's pretty obvious, don't you think?
I think it is. I think it's very obvious. I feel like if we were to, look at this book and put the Gotham meter, if we were just focusing on one book specifically, this category would have a 10, no problem.
Yeah, because, of course, Harry is our hero, Voldemort is our villain, and of course we have Hermione, heroine. But it expands beyond that. You have Harry's allies, like the Order of the Phoenix, and then Voldemort has his little lackeys, the Death Eaters, and so they're all these, layers, because, Voldemort's ultimate endgame is world domination, and so he doesn't, he has to have his own sort of army and followers. And just reading heroes, heroines, and villains, it makes, again, you cannot talk about Harry Potter just in this climate without discussing the transphobic debacle. It made me think about some articles, I don't know who came up with it first, but some articles have, asserted the idea that, that Rowling's transphobia is not surprising because she wrote a book that was very, even though it does get a little nuanced in some ways, but her main thing was Harry's the good guy and Voldemort's the bad guy. We have the Chosen One and we have Wizard Hitler. Hitler is bad. It's very easy to look at Hitler and say Hitler was bad. But, now that we're moving away from more overt forms of racism and sexism and just trying to battle subtle institutionalizations of those harmful discrimination, and that's significantly harder, and people like J.K. Rowling with their transphobia want to dismiss all the fights we had to have are over, people are equal now, and it's no, we're not.
Yeah, that's I can understand the simplicity of Harry's good, Voldemort's bad, let's all move on. And then what a nice picture perfect, easy way to operate. And and as you said, that's just, it just doesn't work like that. And, again, I don't know a lot about Voldemort's demise. I do know a little bit about Harry's evolution. I will say, as a hero, he irritated me in a couple of books. And I don't know if that's like blasphemy amongst the Harry Potter world, but sometimes I was
not
like,
really, no. People really hate Harry in book five, but actually book five is my favorite. So.
Okay. Well, I will learn why. Sometimes I was just like, it wasn't like frustrated with his choices, because I also know I'm reading this book from a different perspective. But it's interesting that kind of idea has been applied to these books, because I guess the book that I'm most familiar with, or obviously resonated with me the most, was the one with Sirius Black. And there was like a whole, you know, thought that this guy was a piece of trash or something, you know, and then it was like, oh, well, maybe not, you know, it's like, maybe take a beat and figure that out. So that really just kind of condenses things down and makes it easy. And I feel like that's a little, I'm not like causing too much drama. I don't know who I'm causing drama with, but it almost seems too easy to say like that her transphobia could be seen because of that. Like, I feel like,
I don't know if I can fully get on board, because she does write a very nuanced character. There is a character that some people hate more than Voldemort, and that's Dolores Umbridge, because she represents someone who is not like directly a bigot or like a racist, but is someone you could meet in real life who is willing to tolerate that sort of harmful ideology passively for the sake of gaining political power. Sound like somebody we know?
Right. Yeah. So those things show like are demonstrative of somebody that's put some thought into some things, and, you know, so interesting. And I think one of the things that I want to spend my time doing is kind of looking at all sides of that argument. Just hoping that she makes a statement that is headed in the right direction.
And she's burned so many bridges with like the Harry Potter actors and like everyone.
Yeah, it just, again, it blows my mind. I mean, this is a person that came out and said like, yeah, sure, Dumbledore's gay, whatever. And like, people were like, oh my gosh, that's so wonderful. You know, before, when like gay marriage and stuff was just kind of slowly gaining traction, she was like, my main character, very beloved character, is a gay man. Awesome. And then to take it's just weird. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I think that might be why I haven't really looked into it too much, because I'm like, I don't know if my brain can compute all
again,
of this.
That's why I rationalize it as, you know, her emotional trauma is trumping her otherwise logical brain, because like, she has to understand these concepts to a certain extent, again, to have written such a series.
Yeah, I feel like we all have our blocks. I certainly have mine. So... yeah.
Alrighty then. So finally, the last category, mystery. And in a way, this was kind of how I was really shook by the Rowling's transphobia, because I respect her. I respected her not just as the like general rags to riches stories, but she is such a heavy influencer on my writing because of the level of mystery she puts into her books.
And obviously she does such like an excellent job with that.
Yeah, and she does such a good job of it. She does it in a way that is, she gives you a little bit of a clue so that if you're really paying attention, you might be able to catch on. It's not just an info dump at the end and cheating like that, because I hated, you as you know, right, when we've discussed other books, that if other mystery novels do that, I will mark it down a few points. The fact that she interweaves, you know, the main mystery, and then a lot of times in many books there will be sub mysteries, like little subplots, mysteries figuring out like what exactly is going on and leaving little clues for even just the tiny subplots.
Yeah.
And so she was such an inspiration to me in that regard, because I always hoped like when eventually I move on from poetry to actually writing a novel, that I will be able to emulate that level of care and meticulousness in dropping those little clues that doesn't appear too obvious. And so when my idol did that, I was just like, no, why do you have to do this to me?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it's like her, the level, the mystery element to these books is so integral to part of it that I started confusing it with the past. So I think that, you know, you were talking about it influencing your writing and then it being like, there have been mystery stories that I have read or thrillers or whatever, because that kind of, you know, outside of gothic, I tend to read easy thrillers sometimes. But that in the 13th tale, I think,
oh yeah,
you and I both had said, like, I did not see that coming. Like, that mystery was pretty, that was great. Now, I don't know about some of the, like, you know, kind of not guessing the end. I know that's just like fun for some people to do, but the writing style and how she weaves things in and out of the story is so well done. I think that, you know, I've read other authors that have written series and they kind of, I noticed with one author in particular, I'm not going to mention who it is, but
in case I interview them,
well, or in case they're like, I want to listen to this gothic podcast. Oh, you bitch. I would be like, oh, I'm sorry. I really liked her books. But that she always kind of used the same little paragraph about five pages in to kind of like reintroduce the character and the characters. And I just kind of was like, lady, I just finished this other book like 2 days ago. I just read that. Whereas with J.K. Rowling, she did a really good job of like, even if you just picked this book up, like if you just randomly picked up book two and you've never read book one, you could read it. Might not be as like rich of an experience, but you could be familiar enough with the characters to read a book and understand it. So I think that's, she's an excellent writer. I mean, I keep saying that, but that it just constantly blows me away when I read the books. I'm like, this late, what? If only. So
each book has its own mystery. Like book number one is, what is the three-headed dog hiding? What is it guarding within the castle? And their whole being little detectives trying to figure that out. In book two, it is, you know, who is opening the Chamber of Secrets and unleashing the scary snake on everyone. In number three, it's, you know, the mystery of Sirius Black. How is he getting into the castle? And did he really commit all the crimes that he's accused of or not? And then in book four, it is, you know, who put Harry's name in the Goblet of Fire? And then in book five, it's what is the secret weapon that Voldemort wants? And so, you know, just the whole, when I first read the first book and I realized, you know, they go through the whole book thinking that it's Snape who wants to steal the Philosopher's Stone because, of course, Snape is an asshole and he's the easy pick.
Right.
But then they realize that it's Quirrell. And my little, like, 12-year-old mind was just like, what? I don't think anyone was anticipating that there would be that level of mystery to it. This is going to be like, oh, this is just, you know, the typical fantasy adventure for kids, like, you know, just whimsical, happy. But the fact that there was so much mystery and so much foundation that was put for the said mystery, it's just like, what?
You do, I mean, she does a great job of making Snape a very unlikable character that you're just going to very easily say like, oh, he's a dick. So this, it must be him. So she does a very good job. What is that called? And not a
red herring.
Yeah. Okay. Red herring. Yeah. Kind of, she does a good job of that with Snape. And I think through other things throughout her writing, you're kind of like I thought Sirius Black was going to be a bad guy and he wasn't necessarily. So yeah, the mystery, she does a good job with mystery.
Yeah, like ultimately, I think the most shocking mystery, I won't say it just because if you don't remember, the mystery of book four, that one, you know, just completely blows your mind.
I'm going to look at book four real quick because I don't know if I have it up here with me. Don't remember. The mystery of book four. What was the title of that one? Gosh.
The Goblet of Fire.
The Goblet of Fire. I'm just going through my brain here. Yes. Who puts it? Okay. And I know who they think it is. And then, sorry, I'm just thinking about it. So this is great, great podcasting right here. It's just me pausing.
That's why I do editing.
Yes. And I don't remember who put his name in the Goblet of Fire.
Yeah, we're going to have, you know, a serious talk of, you know, exactly how much, even if you read it, how much do you remember so that you can enjoy it a second time?
Yeah, it's just, oh my gosh, it is, it's been a minute since I've reread these, and I haven't spent as much time as you have, which is awesome, and I'm glad to revisit it.
Alrighty then. So that covers all the Gothometer categories, which, again, as I said, the Gothometer categories came from an actual article about, you know, how much of Harry Potter is Gothic. I just wanted to end with just two passages that I wanted to pick out. One from Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Yeah, let me pull it up. It's right when he enters the Chamber of Secrets. Harry was standing at the end of a very long, dimly lit chamber. Towering stone pillars entwined with more carved serpents rose to support a ceiling lost in darkness, casting long black shadows through the odd greenish gloom that filled the place. He pulled out his wand and moved forward between the serpentine columns. Every careful footstep echoed loudly off the shadowy walls. He kept his eyes narrowed, ready to clamp them shut at the small sight of movement. The hollow eye sockets of the stone snake seemed to be following him more than once. With a jolt of the stomach, he thought he saw one stir. So isn't that the most Gothic thing you ever read?
It's very, I think that we, if anything, have established very much that these are very Gothic books. There's no doubt in my mind.
That is from book two, and then I also wanted to read a little bit from book three, Prisoner of Azkaban. The fat lady, you know, this is the lady who's the portrait who guards Gryffindor Tower. The fat lady had vanished from her portrait, which had been slashed so viciously that strips of canvas littered the floor. Great chunks of it had been torn away completely. Dumbledore took one quick look at the ruined painting and turned, his eyes somber, to see Professors McGonagall, Lupin, and Snape hurrying towards him. We need to find her. And they eventually come across Peeves, who says he knows where she is. And Dumbledore asks, did she say who did it? Oh, yes, Professor Head, said Peeves, with an air of one cradling a large bombshell in his arms. He got very angry when she wouldn't let him in, you see. Peeves slipped over and grinned at Dumbledore from between his own legs. Nasty temper he's got, that Sirius Black. Yeah, definitely amping up on the thriller element of, you know, just God of the Gothic, both just from Sirius Black, crazy convict coming to get you, you know, the boogeyman, but then also, again, just the portrait that is so iconic from the Castle of Otranto.
Right, yeah, that kind of theme of, I feel like that's almost like a horror. I think I mentioned the Haunted Mansion, the Disney Haunted Mansion, like the portrait with the eyes.
That was one of my favorite rides.
Me too. It's a tie
between that and Pirates of the Caribbean.
I really liked the Tower of Terror. So that one was fun.
I could not do Tower of Terror.
It was, my brother and I watched a lot of Twilight Zone when we were kids.
No, it's just, so. I'm sure the inside of it is brilliant and I would love to walk it, but I don't want to go on the ride. I just don't want to be in the elevator just falling to my death.
Man, I loved that ride so much. That was so fun to me. But that is okay. But the Haunted Mansion, I have that wallpaper as my Zoom background right now because it's just so great.
You know, in the Haunted Mansion where they have the ghost in the mirrors as you leave the ride?
Yes. Yeah.
So actually, they use the same technology at the Harry Potter amusement park in Orlando, where in the girls' bathroom, Moaning Myrtle is in the mirror.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
I know. It's so cute.
I have not been there. I'm assuming.
Neither have I. And I'm not going to go because I'm not going to financially endorse J.K. Rowling anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm definitely not going anywhere right now. So, but wonderful. I think that this has been very insightful to me about just all the nuances and things like that in Harry Potter that I may have overlooked. And I think that with any reading, I'm not trying to give myself an out here, but there's a lot of reading for, you know, kind of sometimes the first pass of reading something is reading for story. And then you go back and you read it again and you realize the kind of the complexities, nuances that may have been overlooked. So first of all, I'm excited to go back and read it to remember some of the things that I've obviously forgotten. And secondly, to look at some of those nuances. And I think that you and I have talked about maybe looking at it without thinking about the author. I know that's something that I do mention sometimes when we talk about, like, it may be a story decision an author makes, but this is, will be a book with a living author who is a very, very public figure. So
that's been the whole crazy thing about this, that it's not like she's a dead author of the 19th century where we can kind of, you know, there's a degree of historical forgiveness that we can prescribe to her to still enjoy things like Jane Eyre and whatnot. She is still very much alive. Yeah, but yeah, that I liked going through doing this exercise because, you know, the typical rhetoric in the fandom is that after book four, things get really, really dark. And so by dark, a lot of people just presume gothic because they just think gothic is synonymous with dark. But I would say that there are some of the early books, just because something's dark doesn't mean it's necessarily dark in the gothic way. And in many ways, I think actually the books 2 and 3 are kind of the most traditionally gothic, with a very, like, I don't know, basic mystery of what's going on in the castle.
Okay.
Because definitely it's I'm tied between 2 and 3 on which would be the most gothic, because I think book 2, just the whole story of the Chamber of Secrets and all of that, that's very compelling. But at the same time, Prisoner of Azkaban has the Dementors, the most gothic, nightmarish creature you can imagine.
Yeah, I think that there's and something that I've kind of learned through our reading this season is there tends to be in some people's mind, and this was a big mess up on advertising for the movie Crimson Peak, which I've mentioned several times. That's a gothic movie. It is not a horror movie. And sometimes people kind of confuse the two. Horror and gothic are not necessarily the same things. There may be elements, and there might be gothic elements. But one of the things that I wanted to, before we wrap up, there's something in gothic literature that I know it kind of, I've only now touched on in my reading of Harry Potter, which is like a little bit of the element of romance and love interests. And that's kind of, there's not a lot of that in the books that I've read so far.
Once they get older and their hormones kick in, then you get it.
Okay. Well, it's just something in gothic literature that we see quite often. And it's just, not that I'm expecting like a, you know, Mr. Rochester situation by any means, but yeah. So books 2 and 3 so far, are you saying of the ones I've read or just out of all of them?
Of the ones you've read, like you get to see a little bit of romance in book 4, picks up in book 5, book 6 is where all the teenage romance happens because they're 16 and hormonal.
Sweet. No. Yeah. Okay. I got you're going to deal with some teenage romance. It's fine.
Yeah. All right, then. Well, thank you so much for listening, everyone. Thank you for lasting with us until episode 10. We are going to take a little bit of a break and, you know, for about a month as we reassess. We haven't fully finalized our list. All I know so far for season 2 is that we are going to start it with Frankenstein and we're going to end it by analyzing the gothic elements in the Twilight Saga.
Ooh, y'all know I'm excited about that. So.
Yes, and that is the one where you will be able to dominate.
Oh, probably. Everybody's going to be like, wow, I didn't realize she was that into it. But trust me,
I'm just wondering, who made you so ashamed of Twilight? Who in your life made you so ashamed of Twilight?
I'll tell you what made me so ashamed of Twilight is that I have a women's and gender studies certificate. And the kind of things that I was reading, the blogs that I was reading, really tore it to shreds and were just basically, there was like a lot of shame around, like, if you enjoyed it, like it was just, you know, it was embarrassing. And how dare, you know, you be interested in something that is basically the equivalent of an abusive relationship. And I just always felt a little taken aback by that because I was like, I guess I could see it, but I didn't really apply that mindset to it. Now, I haven't read the books in quite a while, but I did read the first one multiple times. So I think it was that, just kind of the discussion around it made me kind of question my feminism a little bit. 50 Shades of Grey did not help the fact that it was rooted in that. Yeah, but I need to give it a reread in all honesty.
And you need to read Midnight Sun.
And I will read Midnight Sun. Yes, I'm super excited about that. But so I think it was just the conversation around it.
And I think maybe because you are a little older, that you were an adult, like out in the world, like hearing this conversation, where I was still kind of hidden in college, where I could be like, I can enjoy Twilight, and I don't really talk to very many people about it, so I didn't get a backlash personally. So
yeah, it just made me feel like a kind of a bad feminist. But to be quite honest, in the world of feminism, there was a lot of judgment, and I have since left that behind and will make my own decisions about things. Thank you very much. So that's where it is. Now I'm not abashed. I love Twilight. It was super fun.
All right, then. So stay tuned for that. You know, keep an eye out on my website for when the first episode of season 2 will come out. And then again, that will be Frankenstein. So thank you so much, everyone. Have a great evening. Bye.